Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. And it is May 20th. Yes, May 20th, Tuesday. And that means next time, May 22nd, is your last exam in here. It's not cumulative. It's only going to be over chapters 13, 14, 16, 17, a little bit of 18, and a little bit of 20. More than likely, I can't remember if I added any questions for 20, but for sure that exam figure is very important. All right, so make sure you know something about FSH, LH, where it comes from, where it goes, something about progesterone and estrogen, where it goes, where it comes from, and what the effect of all those different hormones are on some target tissues. And all of that is in the exam figure. So that is also the drawing for today and on Thursday in lab. So even on Thursday, some of you will have lab after the final exam. So please make sure you go to lab and do that drawing, right? So you still have to go to lab. Even the, what's the last one? 5 o'clock lab? 4 o'clock lab? The 4 o'clock lab. Okay, that's really bizarre. It's really strange that we have those labs after the final exam, but I had nothing to do with that schedule. I got roped into it. Yes?
Are you going to post the recommended online quiz questions for chapter
18? Yeah, there aren't any. Yep, just end of chapter questions. So whatever in the study guide right now works. So there's no online study questions for those chapters. Okay. So if you want a key on an understanding, then it's those exam figures. Use the exam figures as a visual mnemonic to know what's going on there. Okay, that's really the beauty of those exam figures, or even you could consider them a concept map. All right, so I don't think we finished up the respiratory system. And what the heck were we talking about last time? All right, so anybody got a question on the schedule? Okay, new, that's great. Okay, let me go to here, like this. Turn some of these lights down, like so. All right, so we talked about mechanics of breathing, some pulmonary disorders, factors affecting ventilation, control of ventilation, hemoglobin, transport of oxygen. I think we still need to talk about CO2 transport in blood. Question? We did? Let me go back to the very last slide just to make sure. Oh, that's right. We maybe even had a little extra time afterwards. Okay, so in that case, I scooted right by it. In that case, I'll just ask you a couple of questions to make sure. How is oxygen transported in the blood? Because that's really part of the job of the circulatory system, is to deliver oxygen everywhere. How does oxygen get delivered by the circulatory system? Because oxygen does not like to dissolve all by itself in water. It has an aversion to doing that. So how does that oxygen get into your blood, which is basically water? How does it get around all over your body? It binds to hemoglobin. That's right. And hemoglobin is a molecule that's found in red blood cells. And that's why there's really no room for any organelles inside of a red blood cell, because it's really packed with hemoglobin and some enzymes, some glycolytic enzymes to make a little bit of ATP, and also a little bit of 2,3-DPG. All right, so that's how oxygen gets carried in the blood, because it has to bind to a carrier molecule, hemoglobin. And remember, every hemoglobin can bind 4 oxygens, because there are 4 subunits to a hemoglobin. And there's a special pigment, there's an iron pigment in each of those 4 subunits, which has the right shaped orbital, the correctly shaped orbital, to bind an oxygen molecule, an O2 molecule. All right, then how is CO2 transported in the cardiovascular system? All right, so oxygen is with hemoglobin. How about CO2? Most of it? Yep, most of it gets converted into bicarbonate, which is a salt, and you know that if you have salt at home, like sodium chloride, and you put some in water, what happens to that sodium chloride? It dissolves right in, right? So bicarbonate ion readily dissolves in water, and so you should be familiar with a chemical reaction that can produce bicarbonate ion from CO2. How does that work? Is that possible? Is that possible? Can carbon dioxide be converted into bicarbonate? Yes. And so tell me something about it. Maybe name the enzyme, or maybe name some intermediates. Carbonic anhydrase. That's right. Very important enzyme, because the conversion of CO2 plus water into carbonic acid, and then carbonic acid dissociated into a hydrogen ion and bicarbonate ion, there's no free energy change. So this reaction can go backwards and forwards, right? And so what determines whether the reaction goes to the right or to the left? Just the concentration of those particular chemicals, right? So if hydrogen ion increases, which means it becomes more acidic, which means what? If the pH decreases, then bicarbonate will be used up to make CO2. If CO2 concentration increases, then the reaction is going to go the other way. Right? If CO2 increases, then that's going to produce more bicarbonate ions in solution. What's the name of that principle, that chemical principle, that says a reaction can go backwards and forwards, and it's only determined by the concentrations of the molecular species in that chemical reaction? Law of mass action. I like that. Or you could say Le Chatelier's principle. Same thing. Most people say Le Chatelier's principle in chemistry, not so much law of mass action. Okay? All right, so that's important. The other thing is, going back to oxygen transport in the blood, we said it has to bind to hemoglobin, right? And we looked at these oxygen saturation curves, like I see right here, and various physiologic conditions can shift this curve to the left or to the right. Ah, here, this is the slide I was looking for. All right, so here is a normal blood pH, or pretty close to normal, 7.4. When the pH becomes acidic, dropping to 7.2, which way is this percent oxyhemoglobin saturation curve shifted? When it going from 7.4 to 7.2? It shifted to the, I wouldn't say up or down, but I would say right or left, and you can see it shifted to the right. Anytime you see a right shift, what does that mean? Without even having, you can analyze these curves to prove this to yourself, but probably you should just know. If there's a right shift that increases oxygen delivery to tissues, right? It enhances oxygen unloading from hemoglobin, right? And in the lungs, hemoglobin is still basically 100% bound with oxygen, but in the tissues where there is decreased PO2, you can see at an acid pH that there is enhanced oxygen unloading in tissues as they become acidic. But that's not the only case that enhances oxygen delivery to tissues. A drop in pH is not the only condition. There are two other important conditions, physiologic conditions that we looked at. There was pH, which we see right here, and the other two are the level of 2,3-DPG. That's a glycolytic intermediate, so that can be produced in a red blood cell because glycolysis is taking effect. And as 2,3-DPG increases when blood oxygen levels decrease, like for instance when you're at high altitude, that shifts the curve to the right as well. And that enhances oxygen delivery to tissues when 2,3-DPG levels increase inside of a cell. All right, so we got pH, we got 2,3-DPG levels, or increasing 2,3-DPG. Decreasing pH, enhanced delivery of oxygen to tissues, and then one more. What happens to muscles when you start to exercise them? And it causes you to start sweating. When muscles exercise, they produce heat, right? So as the temperature increases, you have enhanced oxygen delivery to tissues. So in all these cases, these saturation curves are shifted to the right, which means what? More oxygen is delivered to tissues. Decreasing pH, increasing temperature, and increasing 2,3-DPG. Okay, so that's probably pretty important for you to know. All right, so any other questions on respiratory system? Okay, I think that's all I wanted to recapitulate. So just remember that oxygen saturation curve in those nice, very simple terms, a shift to the right, shift to the left, that tells you a lot. Okay. All right, so now let's go on to urinary system. I get to talk about some of this stuff. Let's see how much time I have to talk about this. And I may or may not have time to look at that reproductive system figure, but I'm maybe not going to have time to talk about it, but that's not because it's not important. It is important to know, right? Not only for the drawing in lab, but also for the exam and for your understanding of the reproductive system. Okay, so here we got urinary system. Make sure I get my cursor options just fine. All right, well, you know a lot about the urinary system already. You know that there are basically four components of the urinary system. Who knows the four components? The four gross structures. Makes it really easy. Kidney, I like. Kidney is number one. Ureter is number two. Urinary bladder, number three. And then one last thing. Urethra. That's how urine leaves the body, right? So those four structures. But you have to know what the structural and functional unit of urine formation is. Anybody have an idea what the structural and functional unit of urine formation is? Yeah, the nephron. So you should be able to draw it out. Make sure you know the differences between the tubular elements and the vascular elements. This is just some standard anatomy that we've gone over in anatomy classes. All right, so there's a lot that I'm not going to talk about here. Ah, but look, here is that diagram that you just described to me. Kidney, ureter, urinary bladder, urethra. All right, and then here are the tubular elements of a nephron. All right, but I don't see any vascular elements right here. But you should be able to tell me, oh, I see like the afferent and efferent arteriole. I take that back. But mostly I see tubular elements. What kind of fluid is in a tubular element? Maybe you have a recall of that from anatomy. That would be good to recall. All right. The other thing I want to know is what kind of fluid is in a vascular element? Maybe that's a better place to start. What kind of fluid is in a vascular element? Blood. Right. So what kind of fluid is in a tubular element? You would not want to say blood. Right, if there is blood in there, then that's not a normal circumstance, right? That's a highly diseased circumstance. So what kind of fluid is in a tubular element? It's going to be filtrate, and it's going to be processed into becoming urine, right? So you got filtrate or urine. All right, so the first part of these tubular elements, you've got the Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule, and inside Bowman's capsule, you have a very leaky capillary called the glomerulus, and fluid filters out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. So when things filter out from glomerulus into Bowman's capsule, what do we call that process? It's not tricky at all. It is called filtration, right? And the product of filtration is what we call filtrate. And filtrate just separates things by the size of molecules. So small molecules can get filtered out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule, like water and salt and glucose, maybe some small proteins, but nothing large, like large proteins, and certainly no cells get filtered out. They're way, way too big. All right, and then that filtrate moves through this convoluted tubule. It's close to Bowman's capsule, so it is the proximal convoluted tubule. And then filtrate moves through the loop of Henle. Here's the descending loop, ascending loop, and then it moves through the second convoluted tubule, which is far away from Bowman's capsule. That is the distal convoluted tubule. All right, so what kind of fluid is in the proximal convoluted tubule that you see right here? Okay, let's start here. What's the fluid inside Bowman's capsule? Okay, well, I would say blood is in the glomerulus, and the glomerulus indeed is inside Bowman's capsule. So I don't want to think about that so much, but I want to know the name of the fluid that's produced by filtration, the fluid that enters Bowman's capsule from the glomerulus. I know the language kind of lets us down a little bit because glomerulus is in there, but I want to really know the name of the fluid and not blood in the glomerulus, but the fluid in Bowman's capsule is filtrate. That's right. What's the name of the fluid in the proximal convoluted tubule? That's filtrate as well. What's the name of the fluid in this ascending loop of Henle? That's filtrate. All right, and how about the distal convoluted tubule? That's filtrate as well. And then once that fluid moves into the collecting duct, we can call it urine, right? All right, so filtrate is going to be processed into becoming urine. And when it gets in the collecting duct, we call it urine. All right, there's a little picture of the ureters. This is all just a review from anatomy. So what is the structural and functional unit of urine formation? I can't remember if I asked you that. That is the nephron, right? So just make sure you recall all those structural and functional units. Like what's the structural and functional unit of life? The cell, that's right. And if you know something about a cell, you know pretty much about how all life works. And if you know how one nephron works, then you know basically how all nephrons work. Right? There might be some little modifications here and there, but they all have the same kind of structures, all the same kinds of functions. Okay. So we said that filtrate starts in glomerular capsule, or Bowman's capsule, moves through the proximal convoluted tubule, then the loop of Henle, distal convoluted tubule, and it's processed into urine. And the three steps that process filtrate, right, from the fluid that we call plasma and blood to urine, the first one is glomerular filtration. That's when fluid leaks out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule. And then tubular reabsorption, things move from filtrate back into the blood. And then some things even are secreted from the blood into a tubular element. We call that tubular secretion. So something becomes urine by these three processing steps right here: filtration, resorption, and secretion. Okay. Some more. Here are the tubular elements. This is just some anatomy. Make sure that you know what is in these tubular elements. And this is the correct order of these various structures. So you should probably know the correct order of these things. Like, it's not important not only to know the phases of mitosis, but what phase follows the next in mitosis, right? So make sure you know the structures or the relative relationship of these structures to each other as well. Nice diagram of a nephron. Okay, the only thing that I didn't talk about so far is here's the afferent arteriole. Here is the glomerulus. And there's exchange taking place in the glomerulus. So what kind of vessel, what kind of blood vessel is the glomerulus? Yeah, because there's exchange taking place. It's a special leaky capillary called a fenestrated capillary. And then the blood leaves the efferent arteriole. And what does an arteriole always deliver blood to? An arteriole is a kind of blood vessel that always takes blood to Well, an arteriole gets blood from an artery. Okay, and an arteriole is just a very tiny artery. So an arteriole takes blood to the next class of vascular things, and that is a capillary. All right, so an arteriole always brings blood to a capillary. So here is the afferent arteriole bringing blood to a capillary that we call the glomerulus. Here's the efferent arteriole that brings blood to another capillary, but in this case, it's a capillary that surrounds all of these tubes, and so we call it the peritubular capillary. And again, what's the function of a capillary? Exchange. So things can exchange between the blood and the filtrate. Blood in this capillary and filtrate in these tubes. Okay, that's the biggest thing. And probably you should be able to recognize all of these little structures right here, like collecting duct, arcuate artery and vein, right? The cortical radiate arteries and veins, things like that. Afferent, efferent arterioles. In Blackboard, I'm sure I have a lot of really nice interactive exercises. On this diagram, maybe we covered this in anatomy, maybe not. I see one nephron here on the left and another nephron on the right, and then this is just a zoomed in region for one of these two. And you notice that there's a little bit of difference between these. And either in both of these cases, the renal corpuscle, which is the glomerulus inside Bowman's capsule, is located in the cortex, right? Here's the renal cortex. So the nephron on the left and the right have the renal corpuscle in the cortex, but you see there's something different about the loop of Henle. The one on the left, the loop of Henle, barely goes into the cortex, and here's the line that separates the cortex from the medulla, right? And so this is what we call a cortical nephron, because the loop of Henle doesn't go very far into the medulla, but this one over here, we see that the loop of Henle goes very deep into the medulla of the kidney. So this is what we call a juxtamedullary nephron, and they have a little bit different function, as you would imagine, because their structure is different, their location is different. This juxtamedullary nephron has the ability to make very small volume of urine that is highly concentrated. So it can concentrate salt in urine. For instance, if you're dehydrated or if you have excess salt in your diet, it is this nephron right here that can do the job for you, right? The juxtamedullary. Okay. All right, glomerular filtration, that's the first process. And that's a fenestrated capillary. It's very leaky, 100 to 400 times more permeable than a regular continuous capillary. I don't know if you have that on the tip of your tongue, a continuous capillary. And that's because it has some little bit different structures. Let's look at Bowman's capsule that we see right here. So here is the outer wall of Bowman's capsule. And I see the space between the glomerulus and this outer wall. And what I want you to think about is a serous membrane, as opposed to a mucous membrane. How many different layers are there to a mucous membrane? And a mucous membrane, remember, lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. How many layers does a mucous membrane have? Mucous membrane, just one layer, okay? But a serous membrane, on the other hand, lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. And how many components does a serous membrane have? It's got three, right? It's got the visceral part, which is right on the organ inside that cavity, then there's a space filled with serous fluid, and then that membrane is continuous with the outer wall of that cavity. And that's what we call the parietal division. So there's a parietal division of a serous membrane, the serous fluid in the space, and then the visceral division on the organ. So use that model to think of how this renal corpuscle works. So here is the outer wall of Bowman's capsule. You could consider this the parietal region, or the parietal division of Bowman's capsule. And then when it reaches the afferent and efferent arteriole, it folds back and actually covers the surface of these capillaries. And so the part of Bowman's capsule that's right on the surface of these capillaries, you should think of that as the visceral division of Bowman's capsule. All right, so here's the parietal, continuous with the visceral, but of course they're in two different places, so they have two different names. Moreover, there is a space between them. Right, and what do we find in this space between the visceral and parietal regions of Bowman's capsule? What do we find in this space right here? That is where we find filtrate. Okay, and that filtrate is produced by pressure inside the glomerulus, forcing it out from this visceral division of Bowman's capsule, right, into this space right here. All right, we got filtrate. So you can see that the visceral division has some special cells. They're called podocytes. And there are big spaces between these foot processes. We call these intercellular clefts. And so small molecules can leak out through these spaces from inside the capillary. And even the endothelium, the wall of the capillary, has spaces between the cells. We call those intercellular clefts as well. And there's even holes in these cells that we call fenestrations. So this is a particularly leaky capillary because of this arrangement. And so sometimes when we look at the podocyte, this little interstitial space right here, a basement membrane, and the wall of the capillary, we call this the filtration membrane. And this is at a really high magnification, so these are all microscopic structures, so you can imagine how delicate a structure this is. So the filtration membrane can easily be damaged by high pressure in a blood vessel. So that will be important for you to know. Okay, so here's just a nice electron micrograph. And here's another electron micrograph. This is, okay. So here is that first process where we have water and solutes in plasma, and they leak out of the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule, and I see it right here. And so this is basically done by pressure. High pressure in the glomerulus, low pressure in Bowman's capsule, and fluid and solutes just move out, like so. Okay, 20% of the plasma that enters the glomerulus right here is placed in the filtrate. So you're losing 20% of your blood as soon as it enters the glomerular capsule. And so you might be really worried about water conservation, because you can't lose 20% of your blood at any particular time without becoming dehydrated, right, and losing blood pressure. All right, so that takes us to the second feature of a nephron, okay, because we want to consider the following. All right, the glomerular filtration is about 115 mLs per minute, so that's just a minute. That's a short period of time, a little bit higher for men. And if we add up all the minutes in a day and multiply it together, we get 180 liters per day of solution leaves your blood and ends up in Bowman's capsule. Well, instead of liters, let's think in gallons. That's 45 gallons a day. So you would dehydrate in just a matter of minutes, right, if all of that fluid was lost in urine, plus if it remained in urine, how much would you have to urinate every day? 45 gallons. Well, we probably wouldn't have time to do much of anything else, right? Okay, so you got to realize that that can't happen. All right, so filtration is really good because we're throwing a lot of things out of our body, but we need to resorb most of that water, right, to maintain homeostasis. All right, so how does that happen? Okay, that happens, okay, by resorption, that second process, tubular resorption of salt and water. All right, so that first tubule, a proximal convoluted tubule, returns most molecules and water from filtrate back into the peritubular capillaries, right? Because you can't afford to lose anywhere near 45 gallons a day. All right? And so about 180 liters get filtered, but we only urinate about 1 to 2 liters in about 24 hours. And as a matter of fact, that's probably a little high. All right, so that urine volume we see is variable, depends on the needs of the body, depends on how your water intake is. But nonetheless, even if we don't drink anything all day long, in order for the kidneys to stay alive, they have to make a minimum of 400 mLs per day. Otherwise, they die. We call that obligatory water loss. All right, so the kidneys have to be doing their job, otherwise they die, and of course, we can't live very long without kidneys. All right, so here is the first process, filtration. Glomerulus, which is blood, into the filtrate in Bowman's capsule. And then resorption starts to take place in this proximal convoluted tubule. And the way this works is that solutes are transported from the filtrate back into the blood. And as the solutes move from filtrate back into the blood, water moves along with it just by diffusion. So water is not actively transported out, but it's just passively resorbed because it goes down a concentration gradient. Here is a figure that you're familiar with. This is in one of the first chapters, probably was an exam figure on the first or second test. But I think we'll go over it just a little bit. And here is the lumen of a kidney tubule. So name this fluid in this region right here, in the lumen of a kidney tubule. And let's even say this is the proximal convoluted tubule. What's the name of this fluid right here? That's the filtrate. Yeah, write that down on your note. If that's not really obvious, go ahead and jot that down. Filtrate. Then here is the wall of the tubule, and we can see that it has microvilli on it. And what's the function of microvilli? Increases surface area. Remember, when you think of surface area, you should think of a doorway for exchange. All right, so it's got all these microvilli, and it has special kind of protein. So here's the apical surface, here's the basal surface. Notice that the membrane proteins are different on the basal surface compared to the apical. So let's take a look at this. All right, so sodium can't enter the cell all by itself. And you know why. Why can't sodium enter this cell? Why can't it go through this membrane? Because it's charged, right? And the membrane is hydrophobic, right? And this particle right here is hydrophilic. So it can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. And neither can glucose, because glucose is a polar molecule because of all those polar hydrogen bonds. All right, so glucose can't enter the cell, so we need a special protein that we have, and I see that we have sodium at a high concentration in the filtrate and low sodium inside the cell. So which way is sodium going to move if it could get across the membrane? It's always going to go from high to low. It's high outside the cell, so sodium is going to enter the cell, right? And because this is a co-transporter, this is an example of what kind of transport, what kind of active transport? This is secondary active transport because I don't see any ATP right here. And the reason why it's active transport, because glucose is going to go from low concentration in the filtrate to high concentration in the cell. Right, so if you go from low concentration to high, is that passive or active? From low to high. Low to high. Yeah, it's active. Say we have a pencil over here, falls on the floor. Can that pencil just jump up on the table? No, you need energy to make that happen, right? So from high to low is passive, low to high is active. All right, well, where does this glucose get energy so that it can go from low concentration to high concentration? It gets it from the gradient of sodium. right? So a gradient is an energy source. And here is sodium. High outside, low inside, so sodium enters, glucose enters. This is an example of co-transport, which is secondary active transport, right? So even though glucose is maybe a low concentration in the filtrate, it still gets put into the plasma. And what do we call that process of going from the filtrate into plasma right here, or filtrate into blood? What do we call that? Process number two, that is tubular resorption. Tubular resorption. So this is an example of tubular resorption in the proximal tubule. And if that glucose wasn't resorbed or put back in the blood, where would this glucose eventually end up? It would be in urine, and then you would excrete it from your body. But what good is glucose? Is glucose good for anything for you? What does it do? Mitochondria love it because they can make ATP from it, right? So you don't want to lose that molecule. That's an important fuel molecule for your body. And just like gasoline is an important fuel molecule for your car, right? You don't want to lose any of it. So if somebody is losing glucose in the urine, in terms of the analogy of your car, that would be like going to the gas station, filling up your gas tank, and then getting an ice pick and putting a hole in your gas tank and have the gasoline dribble out of your gas tank, right? So your body wants to get all the glucose out of this filtrate, so none goes in urine, so all that glucose ends up in the body. All right, so now we have high concentration of glucose inside the cell, like we said, and we also said that there's low sodium. But if sodium is entering from this apical surface, how do we maintain low sodium inside of this cell? And you're very familiar with that because, you know, there are pumps for sodium and potassium all the time, right? And here is that really famous pump that you're aware of, the sodium-potassium ATP pump. And how does that work? Sodium and potassium go two different ways. Which way does sodium go? Sodium should be where? High outside or inside the cell? Sodium should be high outside. And what about potassium? High inside or outside? Potassium high inside. So here's that sodium-potassium ATP pump. So sodium from the filtrate enters the cell. It gets pumped out at the basolateral end, right? So sodium gets pumped out, and then it can enter the bloodstream. So sodium is always maintained low concentration inside the cell. And you're really familiar with that, because that's how RMP gets established, partially because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump. And potassium also then enters the cell, right? Because these two molecules go, sodium and potassium go in opposite directions. So potassium then is leaving the blood. All right, but I see an ATP molecule for this protein. So what kind of active transport is happening here? I see ATP is necessary. That's primary active transport, right? Primary active transport. All right, and most of the energy in your body is used. All those calories that you consume every day, most of them are used just to maintain all of these sodium, potassium, ATP pumps in all of the cells of your body. So that, for instance, this one process can take place in the kidneys. And so that leads me to the next question. Do you think your kidneys are highly metabolic? Your kidneys need a lot of ATP. Yeah, because it has to process filtrate 24 hours a day. So kidneys are one of the more energetically demanding tissues in your body because they're working all the time just with these pumps. All right, so one last thing. We had glucose, low concentration in the filtrate, high concentration in the cell, relatively low concentration in the blood, but remember, glucose can't move across the membrane. So here we have glucose going from high concentration in the cell to relatively low in the blood. How does that glucose get out? Name that process. Is it active or passive? From high to low is passive, right? But we said glucose can't diffuse across this membrane unless it has a special channel or transporter. And so here is going from high concentration to low. That's not active transport. That is passive transport. But because you need this carrier protein right here, we call that facilitated diffusion. So this is really a marvelous slide. We went over it at the beginning of class, but now hopefully it sort of makes sense to you, right, by knowing all of these different kinds of processes, active, passive, diffusion, these transporters, the sodium potassium pump, and co-transport, all that kind of stuff. All right, so here we have an example of how salt and glucose get resorbed from the filtrate and put back into the blood. And this happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. And these things are working 100% of the time, and they can't adjust themselves. They can't slow down. They can't speed up. They're just going like when you're driving your car, you push the accelerator all the way to the floor all the time. That's the proximal convoluted tubule. Can't make adjustments. But it's the job of the other tubules to make fine adjustments in resorption to maintain homeostasis of blood pressure and salt concentration in your body. But the proximal tubule is just working 100% all the time. All right, so here we see that salt is resorbed, glucose is resorbed, and sodium is a cation, so what will move along with it is an anion chlorine, and as the osmolality of this fluid increases, then water will move by diffusion, so water gets resorbed as well. So sodium resorption is an active process that you saw by that sodium-potassium ATP pump, right? But water follows just by diffusion, so that is a passive process, and that's in that proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, who's got a question about that? Any question about that? Okay. All right, so about 65% of the sodium that is filtered gets reabsorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. And the remaining 20% is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle, and it's resorbed variably depending on conditions. So about 85%, right, 65 and 25, 85% of the filtered water and salt that end up in Bowman's capsule get resorbed early in the nephron, proximal convoluted tubule, and loop of Henle. And like I said, this is works 100% of its capacity, and it's independent of water and salt levels in your body. Right? But the nephron can make adjustments, and it makes adjustments in the different parts of the nephron, like the distal convoluted tubule and the collecting duct. Right? The remaining 15% is resorbed variably depending on the level of hydration in your body. All right, and one of these areas is the collecting duct. And the collecting duct has receptors for something called antidiuretic hormone, ADH. What does antidiuretic hormone do for you? Antidiuretic. Yeah, it helps you retain water, right, in your body, which means then that water is resorbed from the filtrate and put back into the plasma, right? So that keeps you from peeing. It makes a small volume of urine. Okay. That's mostly at the collecting duct. Let me look at the next slide. Okay. All right, so here is a little bit of a flow diagram. Water can't diffuse through the cell membranes of the cells that make up the collecting duct. There has to be special pores, and those pores are what we call aquaporins. All right, so let's look at this flow diagram right here. When you're dehydrated, maybe due to low water intake, what happens to the saltiness of your blood when you're dehydrated? Solute concentration increases, and remember when we measure osmolality, that's a measure of the solute in blood. So as osmolality increases, the saltiness increases, and there are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus that can measure how salty your blood is or how concentrated the solutes are compared to water. And there's a set point, compares that information to a set point, makes a decision, sends that decision out to the posterior pituitary. So the initial stimulus was dehydration, so the posterior pituitary will then release antidiuretic hormone for you to what? Retain water to combat this dehydrated state. And ADH is a hormone. What's another hormone from the posterior pituitary, just for fun? Oxytocin, right? It's the only two. It's only ADH and oxytocin from the posterior pituitary. All right, so you have increased levels of ADH, and there are receptors for ADH in the kidney, so they bind to the receptors, and it causes resorption of water. What does that mean? Water moving from filtrate back into the blood, right? So you have less water excreted in urine, and that does what? Does that add to or subtract from this initial stimulus of dehydration? Subtract. So that's a really nice negative feedback mechanism, right? So then on the other hand, if you're overhydrated, then osmolality decreases, posterior pituitary decreases the amount of ADH that it secretes, so you have less water resorption. So if you have less water resorption from filtrate, where does it stay? Where does it end up? it ends up in urine, and then you excrete that excess water from your body, right? And again, that subtracts from this initial stimulus right here. All right, the next figure is not in your book, but it's an important exam figure because it goes over a bunch of stuff that we've talked about in this class. So the first thing to understand on this diagram, and this diagram is nicely color-coded, but the ones, of course, in your study guide are just black and white, but maybe you can see some nice distinctions. I see a blood vessel over here, right? So here's the endothelium of a blood vessel. So here we have blood or plasma. Then we have some interstitial space, and then here we have the wall of the nephron, and I can see it's just a simple cuboidal epithelium, right? There's only one layer of cells. And then here's the lumen of that tubule. And so we could consider this, for instance, like the collecting duct of a nephron, right? And we have water in the filtrate. Water can't get into the cell unless there's a special pore. What's the name of that pore? That's an aquaporin, okay? The aquaporin has to be in this apical surface in order for water to move in, and that's just by passive motion. So that means that there has to be higher concentration of water in the filtrate compared to the cell for water to move in. Right? And that's exactly what we see. We see that the filtrate has 300 milliosmolar concentration, right? But the concentration inside the cell of solutes is even higher. It's double, right? So water will diffuse through this aquaporin inside the cell. And let's look at the salt concentration in this interstitial fluid in the blood. It's higher still. So these spaces are even saltier compared to inside the cell. So water is at a high concentration inside the cell, right? A little bit lower here and even lower still in the blood. So will water want to go from high concentration to low concentration? Absolutely, just by diffusion, right? But it can only do it through these channels. All right, so how does your body regulate this? Well, here we have a molecule of vasopressin in the blood. Where does this vasopressin come from? Posterior pituitary, because vasopressin is another name for ADH, antidiuretic hormone. Exactly the same thing. So here's ADH. If you want to mark your slide up, go ahead, mark it up. I think once upon a time I even asked somebody on a quiz, not a quiz, but a test. Okay, what's vasopressin? It is ADH, right? Same thing, from the posterior pituitary. All right, and that is a compound that dissolves in water. I think it's a small polypeptide, all right? And it diffuses through the endothelium. And since it is a hydrophilic compound, can it get inside of this cell that makes up the wall of the nephron? Can it go across the membrane? Because it's hydrophilic. It can't get through the phospholipid bilayer. So if there is a receptor for ADH, where does it have to be? It has to be outside the cell, right, on the cell membrane. And look what we got right here. We have an ADH receptor. And it's extracellular, right? It's not intracellular. And when ADH binds to this receptor through a cascade mechanism, or probably through a G-protein coupled receptor, then ATP is converted into cyclic AMP. And what do you know about cyclic AMP? It's used as an important second messenger in many signal transduction schemes in your body, right? So what's the first messenger in this scheme that we're looking at right here? The first messenger is ADH, antidiuretic hormone. And where do you always find that first messenger? It's always outside the cell. And the second messenger is cyclic AMP, and where do you always find that? Inside the cell. Okay, so if cyclic AMP levels increase, right, it has an effect on these endosomes. And remember what an endosome is. It's a vesicle inside the cell that has important membrane components already built into that vesicle. But when it's an endosome, these components are inactive, but in order for them to gain activity, this endosome has to be inserted into the plasma membrane, and then these elements can do their job. So these are what we see to be aquaporins. When they're in an endosome, they really have no function, but they take a long time to build, right? But since they're in an endosome, ADH can have almost an immediate effect because it's going to cause the fusion of these endosomes to the plasma membrane, and then now where do you have all of these aquaporins? In the cell membrane instead of the endosomes, and then water can move across the cell into plasma. Okay, so that's the beauty of these endosomes. What was another kind of membrane protein that your body makes all the time, puts in reserve, so it can be activated very quickly, right, at a moment's notice. They're in endosomes, but it needs a signal to be put into the membrane. What kind of system was that? It had to do with glucose transport, the GLUT4 transporters. Okay, and what's the signal for taking GLUT4 transporters that are in an endosome and putting them in the plasma membrane? So that a cell could take glucose up from the blood. Insulin, yeah, insulin is that passport that makes sure that all these endosomes with those GLUT4 transporters gets put into the plasma membrane so that glucose can enter the cell. And as glucose enters the cell, what happens to blood glucose concentration? It decreases, right? So you should know that insulin causes a decrease in blood sugar because those GLUT4 transporters are put in the membrane. All right, so this is the mechanism of action for antidiuretic hormone, otherwise known as vasopressin. Okay, who's got a question on this slide right here? Anybody got a question on this one? Yeah. Yeah, it's in the study guide. The key and the unlabeled figure is. It's not in your PowerPoint? It's not in your PowerPoint. Ooh, okay. I'm lucky I have it in mine because I really like to talk about this one. Okay, so it is in your, it's in your study guide for sure. So this figure, of course, black and white, and then one with all these things erased from it. Okay, so remember, vasopressin, hydrophilic, which means there's an extracellular receptor, and the job of antidiuretic hormone is to move water from the filtrate back into your body or back into the blood. Okay, that's its job. Okay, renal plasma clearance. Okay. Well, here are the three processes that produce urine. The first one is filtration. The second one is resorption. Like, give me an example of a molecule you don't want to lose too much of, so it's taken from the filtrate and put back in the blood. Glucose, yeah. Water even, right, so that you don't dehydrate. So a lot of things get resorbed. Sodium, you don't want to lose too many electrolytes. All right, secretion goes the other way. And usually these are all active processes where there are harmful compounds in the blood, and not every single harmful compound gets filtered into Bowman's capsule. Some actually leave through the efferent arteriole, but nonetheless, it's still a harmful compound, and you don't want it in your body. So the kidney recognizes that and can take some of those harmful compounds and puts it into the filtrate, and then where does it end up? In urine, and you excrete it from your body. So some of those harmful compounds would be metabolite of protein degradation called ammonia. Ammonia is converted into urea. Both are pretty toxic. Ammonia is much more toxic than urea, but both are toxic. And the nephron has the ability to grab urea that's in the blood from a peritubular capillary and put it in the filtrate so that you can excrete it from your body. So that is a good example for secretion. Or if you have way too much sodium in your diet, the kidney can secrete sodium. If you have too much acid in your body, the nephron can also secrete hydrogen ions into the filtrate so that you can excrete it. All right, so these are the three processes. So what does this excretion amount to? If we want a mathematical equation that tells us something about excretion, what would we have to do with these three terms right here? Excretion is equal to, all right, we see that this is urine. Urine formation is equal to the filtration plus secretion minus resorption, right? Because something's resorbed, doesn't end up in urine. If something's filtrated, could end up in urine. If something is secreted, it will end up in urine, right? So excretion is equal to filtration plus secretion minus resorption. I think we have a slide. Ah, look at this right here. That shows us right there. Only these three processes. Remember, this proximal tubule right here is working 100% of the time. No adjustments. It's only on those distal tubules where ADH and even aldosterone can have an effect. All right, so 20% of all your blood is filtered, right? And so 20% enters that efferent arteriole, and resorption has to get most of this water back into your body, otherwise you dehydrate. But even some things that can't be filtered, like I said, still can be secreted into the filtrate. Okay, glucose. Under normal circumstances, how much glucose is found in the urine in a normal individual? How much glucose? Let's see. No, nobody had lab today. So lab today is urine. You'll be doing a taste test for glucose. Okay. Okay. So how much glucose should be in the urine of a normal person? Zero. That's right. Should not taste sweet at all. Because all the glucose that's in the filtrate gets resorbed because there are those special transporters. Right? But you have a finite number of transporters, and if the glucose concentration in blood is so high that it saturates all those transporters, then there'll be some glucose left in the filtrate that ends up in urine, and then you excrete that from your body. So that level is called the transport maximum. And if the level in blood exceeds transport maximum, then we say that transporter is saturated and you will lose glucose. So when is glucose too high in the blood and it surpasses this transport mechanism and all these transporters get saturated? Under what kinds of pathological conditions is that? That's called diabetes mellitus, right? Okay, so when your concentration of glucose in the blood is greater than 180 to 200 milligrams per 100 mLs of plasma, then it exceeds the renal plasma threshold, and glucose is not resorbed, 100% is not resorbed, some is left in filtrate, and it ends up in urine. And then how would urine taste? Sweet, it's going to have a lot of glucose. As a matter of fact, somebody that has really uncontrolled diabetes, you can even see sugar crystals in their urine. It will look like candy to some extent. Okay, and way back when, not too long ago, that was the diagnosis for diabetes mellitus. It was just a taste test of urine. Who would taste it? Probably not the doctor. Probably a graduate student or somebody else. Okay? But if you're the only doctor in Tucumcari, Arizona, and there's no other doctor in 1,000 miles, then yeah, you tasted urine. And that was a really nice, easy test. You probably didn't have to pay many lawyers to have a license to do that. Nobody got sued. Okay? Okay. So if you have sugar levels above this in your blood, we call that hyperglycemia. And when you lose glucose in the blood because you've exceeded that renal plasma threshold, then we call that glycosuria, when you lose glucose in the urine. Of course, that's not good for all kinds of reasons, which we can't really get into at the moment. So amino acids and glucose get resorbed that way because there are special transporters that allow that to happen. Okay, well, you all know the importance of sodium and potassium. What's the importance of sodium and potassium in your body? It regulates all those nifty electrical properties of cells, like resting membrane potential, right, excitability and all that kind of stuff. All right, so it's important to have nice regulation of these ions. So ADH was important for water. There's another compound that's important and concentrate more on sodium and potassium, and that hormone is aldosterone. All right, so aldosterone manages the sodium and potassium balance inside your body, and in so doing, it helps also regulate water balance in your body, and then, of course, it helps regulate blood pressure, for instance. All right, so 90% of the sodium and potassium is resorbed before that distal tubule, right, somewhere in the proximal area of the nephron, and the remaining is resorbed variably depending on the needs of the body, which balances out the excretion and input. And it's regulated by aldosterone. Okay. No doubt you're going to have some questions about aldosterone in the future after you pass this class, probably all the time. So you got to be familiar with aldosterone. Right? And you want to be thinking of potassium and sodium. And remember, after filtration, what are the two processes? So you got filtration, then you have resorption and secretion, right? All right, so you got potassium and sodium, and you've got secretion and resorption, and you have to know how aldosterone affects these things, all right? Well, it's easy to remember sodium and potassium, right? And you might get a question, aldosterone is important or helps regulate the secretion of sodium and potassium. Sodium and potassium, that could be one answer. And could that be a right answer? Let's go to the next answer. Another answer could be aldosterone enhances the resorption of sodium and potassium. And you might have another answer, and the answer might be it enhances the secretion of potassium, but the resorption of sodium, which means it's going in opposite directions. All right, so in the first two answers, sodium and potassium are going the same way. It didn't matter if it was both going in, both going out. The last answer was sodium and potassium going in opposite directions, and you know what? That has got to be the right answer. All right, so just kind of focus your attention. When sodium and potassium go in opposite directions, then that's how aldosterone works. And I'll show you how it will be easy to remember that. All right, in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed in the distal tubule and the collecting duct. All right, when aldosterone is high, all the remaining sodium is resorbed, so there won't be any sodium left in the urine. Okay, so here is potassium under normal circumstances. Potassium is almost completely resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, but when it is high in your body, then it can even be secreted back into the filtrate. Right? And tell me the name of the hormone that enhances this secretion of potassium into the filtrate. It is aldosterone. Okay? And if potassium is going in, which way is sodium going? It's going out of the filtrate back into your body. All right, now what kind of compound is aldosterone? I want to probably come back to that. What kind of compound is aldosterone? What kind of hormone is aldosterone? It's a mineralocorticoid because it's adjusting minerals like sodium and potassium. And you know it comes from the adrenal cortex. Can you kind of remember the shape of aldosterone? It's similar to cortisone, similar to estrogen, similar to progesterone, similar to testosterone, similar to cholesterol, which means it's a steroid. That's right, it's a steroid. And that belongs to a general class of compounds that we call lipids. And are lipids water-soluble? They are not. They are hydrophobic, right? Okay, so let's take a look at this slide right here. Aldosterone, how it works in terms of sodium and potassium. So here we have aldosterone in the blood. Remember, it doesn't like to dissolve in water, so it's on a carrier protein. So it's high concentration on those carrier proteins. Some of it can jump off and be dissolved in water, but it's a very low concentration. But that's in equilibrium. This is happening all the time. So here you have high aldosterone in the blood, low in this interstitial fluid. Some will diffuse out of the blood into this interstitial fluid, and it's even lower inside of the cell. And so here we have high aldosterone in the interstitial fluid, low inside the cell. So which way is aldosterone going to diffuse? From high to low, right? So it will want to enter the cell, but can it enter the cell? What kind of compound is aldosterone? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's a steroid, so it is hydrophobic. It's hydrophobic. What can you tell me about the membrane? Hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It's hydrophobic, so aldosterone hydrophobic, membrane hydrophobic, which means it can diffuse right across, right? So if it can diffuse inside the cell, does it have an extracellular receptor? It does not. It has a cytoplasmic receptor, right? And we mentioned that most steroid hormones, when they have cytoplasmic receptors work through a genomic action, which means that they can start protein synthesis, right? So here we have aldosterone binding to a cytoplasmic receptor that acts as a transcription factor. What can you tell me about transcription? It's a step. It's a step in what? Protein synthesis. Last step? First step? First step, yeah. For protein synthesis, how many steps are there? There's two. First one is transcription, second one is translation, right? And so this aldosterone receptor, when it binds aldosterone, acts as a transcription factor, which means that it can initiate transcription, right? Transcription is what? The conversion of DNA into messenger RNA. That messenger RNA leaves the cell. Now that messenger RNA can build a whole bunch of proteins that the cell didn't have before aldosterone bound to its receptor, right? And those additional proteins are going to change the physiology of the cell, because aldosterone is that nice transcription factor. All right, so we got messenger RNA coming out of the nucleus, And then we have some new proteins. These new proteins can be pumps that can be put into the membrane, okay, like over here. It could be new channels, all right, and it can be some molecules that moderate existing channels by opening or closing them. All right, so what do we call that going from messenger RNA to proteins inside the cell? It's translation, right? So here's that other step. So transcription is the first step, translation is the second. That gives you new proteins for new kinds of functions inside the cell. It can make new channels. All right, well, what are we interested in? What did we say about aldosterone? Mineralocorticoid, important for sodium and potassium, right? So that's what we're going to be concerned about. Okay. Where do we have a high concentration of potassium in a cell, inside or outside the cell? Potassium is high inside the cell. What about sodium? It's going to be high outside, so it's going to be low inside the cell. All right, so here we have those three same areas. We got blood, we got interstitial fluid, we got the wall of that nephron tube, and then here is the lumen of the tubule that has filtrate in it. Okay? And it just so happens that we have high sodium in the filtrate, low sodium inside the cell. You just told me there's always low sodium inside the cell. Here is a sodium channel. So what is sodium going to do? Move from high concentration to low just by diffusion, and it can get across the membrane because there's a channel for it. If that channel wasn't there, then it couldn't move across the membrane. So it enters the cell. And now what did we say about potassium, high or low inside the cell? High inside the cell. It is low in this lumen, so sodium will diffuse from inside the cell into the filtrate, right? And of course, we call that secretion, right? So we see that sodium and potassium are going in two different directions, right? And they each have their own membrane channel right here, all right? Well, what maintains sodium at a low concentration inside the cell? And what maintains potassium at a high concentration inside the cell? And this is the reason why we burn so many calories a day. This is the mechanism that uses up most of the energy that we consume, that we have in our diet, which is the, we all know this, one of the most responsible components for maintaining the resting membrane potential is the, we got it right here, sodium going one way, potassium going the other way, I see ATP, which means what? What kind of transport is this? Primary active transport. All right, potassium going in, sodium going out. This is what? Just the old usual sodium-potassium ATP pump that's working on this wall of the kidney tubule. And so sodium goes from the filtrate into the cell. The pump pumps it out into the interstitial space, and then it diffuses into the blood. So what do we call this process of sodium going from the filtrate back into the blood? Resorption. And here we have potassium in the blood. It's pumped into the cell by that same pump. Remember, these have to operate together. Now you have high concentration of potassium inside the cell, low in the tubule. And so eventually we get potassium in blood ending up in filtrate. What do we call that? Secretion. And so if you're going to focus on one thing on this slide, what's the key element that is moving the sodium around? Aldosterone is a control signal. Okay, but what's the feature that we see on the slide that makes sure that this works, so that potassium is secreted and sodium is resorbed? Yes, yeah, that ATP, and in particular, somebody said it already back there, it is this pump right here. And are you familiar with that sodium-potassium ATP pump? Yeah, you're really familiar with it. So what can you tell me about aldosterone? Oh, gee, you're really familiar with that because you know almost everything there is to know about this sodium-potassium ATP pump, right? So hopefully, right, when you're on a board exam or something, you're always going to remember that aldosterone causes sodium and potassium to go in opposite directions, but maybe even more specifically, sodium is going to be pumped out of the cell back into the body, and potassium is going to be pumped from the body into the filtrate, right? So it's going to be potassium secretion and sodium resorption. That's what aldosterone does. And aldosterone works because of why? Of this sodium-potassium ATP pump. So you should be really familiar with that sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so this is just the wall of some part of the distal nephron. All right, so that's why this is an important exam figure, and that other one on ADH is an important exam figure because it just kind of ties everything together that you learned. Did you learn anything about transcription in this class? Yeah. What about translation? Yeah, genetic code, all that kind of stuff. Is there a big difference between hydrophobic and hydrophilic molecules? Yeah, because of the cell membrane and all that stuff, right? And what kind of compounds are hydrophobic, like are lipids hydrophobic or hydrophilic? They're hydrophobic, right? So all these things are really important physical chemistry properties that now you're aware of. Okay. I think that's all I want to say about the urinary system today. And since today is the last day, then that's all I can say. Because I do want to go over that reproductive figure one time with you guys, if I have it. But it's where? It's in a study guide someplace, right? I don't know if I have figures in your textbook. And this figure is really good. I wish the anatomy book had, maybe this is it right here. I wish the anatomy book had a figure like this. It's all chopped, it has it, but it's all chopped up into pieces. And I forget, and I've never put it all together. All right, so let's take a look at this illustration right here. Well, what do we got? Well, we have an ovary in this top row right here. And we see some things in the ovary. These are follicles. And the job of the ovary, one of the jobs of the ovary is to make a gamete, a female gamete. And do you know what a female gamete is, the name of a female gamete? Okay. It's an egg. It's an oocyte. Okay, so the primary reproductive structure in a woman is an ovary. The primary in a male is a testes. And these ovaries and testes produce steroid hormones, for instance, like estrogen and progesterone, and in the male, testosterone. But they have another function, and that they produce a gamete. And a gamete can either be an oocyte that we see right here, because we're looking at the female reproductive system, but in the male, what is the male gamete? It is a sperm cell. Yeah, so it's a sperm. All right, so the interesting thing about a gamete is that it has half the number of chromosomes compared to all of the other cells that you have in your body. It has half the number, which makes perfect sense because what happens during fertilization? What's going on with fertilization? You have an egg and a sperm, and what happens to them? They send each other letters, text? No, they join together, right? So that's called fertilization. So it takes all of the chromosomes in the sperm and all the chromosomes in this egg, they're joined together, and then they have the complete and total number of chromosomes that a human body should have, which is 46. Right, so an egg has 23 and a sperm have 23. When they add together, you get 46, which is the normal number of chromosomes in a somatic cell in your body. All right, so here is how an oocyte develops inside of an ovary. Right? So here I see an oocyte here and here and here, but it's in a structure we call a follicle. And what can you tell me about a follicle from day 1 to day 7 to day 14? Is the color the same? What about the shape? Shape is sort of the same. What about size? Definitely different, right? So this is growing, right? So this follicle is growing. And as a matter of fact, this follicle is going to spit out this egg through a process we call ovulation right at mid-cycle, day 14. We call that ovulation. So here is now a nice oocyte that can be fertilized. And the follicle remains in the ovary. And this oocyte right here travels around in the body somehow or another. All right, so what causes this follicle to develop to produce a mature follicle that can ovulate an egg? There's a hormone from the anterior pituitary called follicle stimulating hormone. So that's not too hard to remember, right? Because follicle stimulating hormone stimulates a follicle to develop. That's its job. Okay. Right at mid-cycle, we have ovulation, and there's another hormone responsible for that, and that is called luteinizing hormone. Right? So there you see a big spike in luteinizing hormone that follows very quickly, or what follows very quickly after that is ovulation. The remnant of that follicle that has lost the egg now doesn't degenerate right away. It becomes a very important endocrine structure. We call this the corpus luteum. Right? There's no longer an oocyte in there, but the follicle as it's developing is an important endocrine organ. It secretes estrogen. Right, so a follicle secretes estrogen, but this corpus luteum, what's left over after ovulation, secretes another sex steroid, which is progesterone. Right, so recall this first part of what's happening inside the ovary, the follicular phase, and then you have a moment where there's ovulation, and that's followed by the second phase, or last phase, that's the luteal phase, and that's dominated by the corpus luteum. So some questions, I suppose, somebody could ask you. What's the hormone that is secreted by the corpus luteum? And you have this in your memory because you're going to draw it on a blank piece of paper. You're going to say, oh, well, that's progesterone. Corpus luteum comes from progesterone. Where does estrogen primarily come from? A follicle, right, as it's developing. And what causes this follicle to develop? It is FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone. And what causes ovulation? Luteinizing hormone, this big surge in luteinizing hormone. All right, so these changes of the follicle and the corpus luteum within the ovary is called the ovarian cycle. And it kind of matches up with, well, what your book calls the menstrual cycle, and many books it's called the uterine cycle. All right, so here we have the ovary, and then down over here we have the uterus. And you all know there's a difference between an ovary and a uterus, right? You're probably really getting burned out at the moment, but probably you know that difference. All right, so what's the effect of these hormones on the uterus, right? So let's just call this the uterine cycle. All right, on day one of the uterine cycle, the endometrium of the uterus is lost, right? It's shed from the body with also a little mild hemorrhage. So these endometrial cells get flushed out of the body, so there's very little left. And then as estrogen levels increase, then the endometrium starts to grow back. And so we have a few cells here, and then more cells, and more cells, and more cells. So what is that process where you start with just a couple cells, and then you get more and more and more and more? That is called proliferation. All right, so here we see endometrial proliferation, right, a lot more cells. And so this is what we call the proliferative phase. The period of menses is called menstruation. Then we have the proliferative phase. And then, okay, right after ovulation, all right, we see that the endometrium is still growing. It still grows a little bit, but some other things happen to it. It increases in vascularity. We have more blood vessels. And there are also glands that secrete something into the lumen of the uterus, all right? So we call these uterine glands. We can guess why they're there. Maybe they enhance the potential for implantation, but I'm not sure anybody really knows for sure what they secrete or why they're there. All right, so these uterine glands develop as well, and this final maturation of the endometrium is not really due to estrogen, but it's due to progesterone. All right, so maturation of the vascular supply in these uterine glands is mostly the result of progesterone. All right, so then progesterone makes sure that the endometrium is viable for implantation. So that's the job of progesterone. And as a matter of fact, the endometrium that we see right here, in order for a pregnancy to be maintained, has to stay in this viable state. It can't regress back to these conditions over here. So progesterone maintains the endometrium in a nice supportive state so that implantation can take place but can also be maintained. So what hormone is really important for maintaining pregnancy? Progesterone. As a matter of fact, that's what its name really means. It means progestational hormone. What's gestation? A period of time when somebody is pregnant. That's gestation, when the fetus is growing, right? So progestational hormone is a hormone that should be high when the body thinks that it is pregnant, or it is a hormone that maintains pregnancy. Okay, progestational hormone. Well, if implantation does not take place, what happens to the level of progesterone through this uterine cycle? Okay, it starts to decrease. What happens to the endometrium when progesterone starts to decrease? The endometrium regresses, and eventually it's lost from the body. All right, so where does this estrogen come from during the proliferative phase? It comes from the growing follicle. And where does progesterone come from during the secretory phase because of these uterine glands are secreting? It comes from the leftover part of a mature follicle that we call the corpus luteum. So primarily estrogen from a follicle, primarily progesterone from a corpus luteum. And what is the other thing that you notice? We said that implantation in this diagram did not take place. So this uterus is not pregnant. What happens to the corpus luteum without implantation? Nice and viable here. Day 21, still viable. But what happens here? Day 25, 26, 27, 28, it regresses, right? It gets resorbed. And as it's going away, so does the level of progesterone, and that triggers the next cycle of the uterine cycle, or menses. All right, so you should be able to think about these different hormones, these four hormones, where they come from, what their effect is on these target tissues, probably the names of these different phases, whether they're in the ovary or the uterus. And then the last thing that you're probably interested in is what happens if implantation takes place. What hormone should stay at a high level if implantation takes place? Yeah, progesterone. All right, and where does that progesterone come from? The corpus luteum. All right, so there is an additional signal. If implantation takes place, then there's a placenta that is starting to grow in the endometrium. The placenta sends a signal, a hormone, to the corpus luteum, and it says, hey, we have implantation taking place. Do not regress. Keep secreting progesterone, right? Or otherwise, pregnancy will be terminated. Right? So that hormone from the placenta to the corpus luteum so that it doesn't regress is, for fun, you should probably know the name of that hormone, because that's the hormone that's measured in the at-home pregnancy tests when you do a urine test. And that's called human chorionic gonadotropin, or HCG. So where does HCG come from? The placenta. And where does it go? To the corpus luteum. And it just maintains the corpus luteum through the first phase of pregnancy. Right. And then the placenta itself can make enough progesterone to where the corpus luteum is no longer needed. All right, so progestational hormone is important to maintain pregnancy, both the myometrium and endometrium. Okay, so you can see how this endometrium grows and regresses. And when it regresses, where do all these endometrial cells end up? Where do they end up? I don't have that slide open, the pictures. It ends up outside the body, right? Because that's what that hemorrhage is for. But remember, the uterus is really connected to the pelvic cavity via the fallopian tube. There's no sphincter or anything. So sometimes in some women, these endometrial cells are not 100% are lost from the body, but they can actually exit through the fallopian tube right into the pelvic cavity. And what's separating the pelvic cavity from the abdominal cavity? Is there anything there? What about between the abdominal cavity and thoracic cavity? Nice diaphragm, right? But there's the abdominal cavity and pelvic cavity are really one thing. So those endometrial cells that have escaped and ended up in the pelvic cavity can end up in the abdominal cavity, and they can implant into mesenteries or other vascular-rich regions of those cavities. And guess what they do? They start to grow during the proliferative phase, right? Right, and through the secretory phase, and then they regress, right, during the menstrual phase. And then what happens during the next cycle? They start to grow again. So that's what we call, anybody know what that process is called? It's very irritating, because those cells don't belong in the pelvic cavity or abdominal cavity. It's called endometriosis. And that can be very inflammatory, very irritating. And some women, it's so irritating that those endometrial cells have to be removed surgically. Okay? I don't know if we know a really good way of controlling it with hormones or anything like that. Fortunately, I think that endometriosis eventually will go away after what happens? What do we call that? Menopause, that's right. Okay. So you probably know somebody with endometriosis, and now you know a little bit about the etiology or how it develops, because some of those cells have escaped. But the fortunate thing is that they can't get into tissues. They're trapped in the cavities. They can't get into muscle. They can't get into bone. So it's not really cancer, right? Because cancer will really infiltrate all these different things. Endometrial cells can't get into the brain. but it still causes an inflammation. It just can't destroy your brain or liver or anything like that, fortunately. That's really good. All right, so this is a really handy figure to understand some of these things that are going on. Any questions on this figure right here? No? Okay. You might want to just draw in a little arrow about HCG, but I don't think I test you on HCG. But HCG goes from where? Like the endometrium or the placenta to the corpus luteum here. And it keeps that corpus luteum viable, kicking out progesterone. Okay. Well, you're still going to be busy for at least 2 more days. That's good. And then after that, wow, I don't know what you're going to do with yourself. You'll have like an identity crisis or something. You won't have anything to do. But still review this information because it's really good information to know. Sign-in sheet is going around, and I'll get this lecture online as soon as I can.